and welcome to New Books in Sociology. I'm your host, Annie Sapukaya. New Books in Sociology is one of the many channels in the New Books Network, a volunteer-driven project where we interview authors about their new books in different fields. This gives listeners the opportunity to learn about new books and new ideas from the authors themselves, and will hopefully make everyone dash to the bookstore. Today I'm going to talk to Leslie Irvine, author of My Dog Always Eats First, Homeless People and Their Animals, published by Lynn Reiner Publishers in 2013. Through interviews with homeless people, the book explores the role of animals in the narrative construction of a positive identity. In addition, Leslie has studied animal sheltering, human-animal play, selfhood among animals, and the feminization of veterinary medicine. Her 2004 book, If You Tame Me, Understanding Our Connection with Animals, received the Distinguished Scholarship Award from the Animals and Society section of the American Sociological Association. Her articles have appeared in many journals, including Society and Animals, Gender and Society, Social Problems, The Sociological Quarterly, Qualitative Sociology, and Symbolic Interaction. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Annie.
So today we are talking to you about your book, My Dog Always Eats First, Homeless People and Their Animals. To begin, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to write this book?
Yes, I am a sociologist at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and for about the past 15 years, I've been studying people's relationships with animals. I've always been interested in animals, always loved animals of all kinds, and it was only starting around 1999 when I came here to Boulder that I had the opportunity to see them in a scholarly sense. And as far as the research on homeless people and their animals, I got an email from an editor at Lynn Reiner Publishers about a book they were interested in doing. And I have to say it's the idea of the editor, Andrew Brzanskis, who had just – we have a lot of homeless people seasonally here in Boulder, as is true of many places, but – we have a lot of regular transients who hang out in particular places with their animals, and he had just become curious about their lives and how they provided for themselves and their animals, and he got in touch with me, and over a few coffee-fueled meetings, we decided on that I would at least begin the research and see whether I took to it, because I wasn't, as I explain in the book, I was not a homelessness researcher, and I wasn't really familiar with that literature or how to do the research at all. So once I got my feet wet and made a few contacts, I decided that it would make a great project.
So how did you find access to these people?
At first, my idea was that I would go up to the people I saw on the street hanging out, and you know how it is when you are looking for something, it's never there. But when you don't need it or want to find it, it's always there every time you turn around. And that was the same thing with homeless people and their dogs in particular, because obviously dogs are, you know, a bit easier to manage, more portable and more obvious in public. But when I went out with my notebook and my voice recorder, I never ran into anybody. And then when I would be, you know, on my way to something else, or when I wasn't prepared to do an interview, there I would see, you know, on street corner after street corner, homeless people with their animals. So I realized how slow that would be, and I started searching the net for clinics, for veterinary clinics, that for the pets of the homeless. And I made a couple of really great connections. I connected with the program known as Vet SOS in San Francisco and the Mercer Street Clinic in Sacramento, and with a very large shelter that does run clinics occasionally in Miami. And then I did contact several people just one-on-one on the street, but the bulk of the interviews were done with people who came to these free clinics for free veterinary clinics for the pets of the homeless. And the veterinarians and the technicians were the gatekeepers who helped explain to people that I was legit and wasn't looking to exploit them in any way. And they had already, for the most part, established trusting relationships with the veterinarians at these clinics because of their animals. So it gave me a level of access that I wouldn't have had just had I just, you know, tried to approach people with the clipboard in hand.
And these are clinics that are free for homeless people to take their animals to? And
they are free, yes. And they do basic health exams, vaccinations, for licensing. And these clinics also do spay and neuter. They require that you spay and neuter your animals. They'll provide services once, and then you have to spay and neuter. And if you don't, you know, you can't keep going back if you haven't spayed or neutered your animal. But in both Sacramento and in San Francisco, there are veterinarians and clinics who will provide coverage for the cost of other kinds of surgeries apart from spay and neuters too. So if an animal needs an eye surgery or a limb removal, there are people who've donated their services. And so oftentimes people have that available to them too.
Did you find that people wanted to talk to you about their pets, or were they kind of hesitant?
For the most part, this is where the veterinarian gatekeepers were really important. I not only had them introduce my research and vouch for me, but because of the way these clinics are set up, people arrive in the morning. In the case of Sacramento, they actually, some people get in line the night before and spend the night sleeping there. But they have to hang out for hours and hours and hours in this line to be seen by one of the veterinarians. And so they have basically not much else to do. They're talking amongst themselves. And so I could just move through the crowd and talk to people. And in many instances, people did seem really appreciative. They would say things like, oh, you know, nobody has ever asked me that before. And homeless people are, you know, they frequently experience terrible treatment from the public on the street. And so to have someone take their situation seriously and to not be a social service provider who's trying to see if they qualify for something, to just be interested in what they have to say, I have to say that people seemed very appreciative of that.
Well, it's interesting. Something that I found that you talk about is that at the beginning of this research, you were a little bit skeptical because, you know, when we see a homeless person and we see them with a dog, we feel like, well, you can't really take care of that dog. We just kind of assume that. I had an experience the other day. I was at a coffee shop and there was a woman who came in maybe about 19, 20 years old, completely stoned out of her mind. And she had this huge, big Labrador. And, you know, you assume, you look at her and you assume, well, you know, she can't take care of them. She really shouldn't keep a dog. And you had that sort of thinking as well when you first began, correct?
I did. What changed me was many years of volunteering at an animal shelter. And there's a story I recount in the opening of the book where I say, there, you know, here in Boulder, we often have very high winds. And one night after about a 70-mile-an-hour windstorm at the shelter, a dog was brought in by animal control who had apparently gotten loose from his yard. And he was a very expensive dog, Shiba Inu, purebred. And he was microchipped, and the staff contacted the guardian, and he took about 4 days to finally get himself over and pick up the dog. And a couple days later, the dog got loose again and showed up at the shelter again. He took his time even contacting the shelter to find out if the dog was there. But eventually, he just decided that the dog was too much of a pain and surrendered him. Meanwhile, there was a homeless man who lived in the mountains in the forest outside of Boulder, and he had actually also lost a dog that in that same windstorm. But he had walked easily 15 miles down to the shelter to check and see if his dog had been turned in. And he kept making these repeated trips, and he made handmade signs to post in the coffee shops and places around, "Have you seen this dog?" And he would hang out at the shelter to wait for animal control to see if they brought his dog in. The staff many, many times saw him crying, and he actually wore out his shoes walking, looking for his dog. And so the staff took up a collection to buy him a new pair of shoes. But this incident made me really question my assumptions about who was the better guardian. You know, the guy who had the house and the yard, but who considered his dog just another inconvenience, or the man who wore his shoes out looking for his lost dog. And so I began to see that you don't, just because you have a house doesn't mean that you can provide good care for an animal. Certainly, I would love to see no homeless people as well as no homeless animals. I think we'd all, for the most part, be better off sheltered from the cold and the heat. But just having that shelter isn't what makes you a good animal guardian.
Mm-hmm. How do homeless people deal with this sort of stigma? Because they're aware that people don't believe they should be keeping pets. And some people outright say it, right? They say it right to their face when they're walking down the street. So what are some of the ways in which they deal with this kind of treatment?
Yeah, that was an eye-opener to hear to a person that when they're out in public with their animals, they just every day get accused, you know, you don't deserve to have a dog. You can't even take care of yourself. Why don't you give your dog up? And the strategies that they used to respond to those kinds of attacks varied somewhat depending on age and time on the street. The homeless youth really responded with anger and a lot of times profanity, like, you know, swearing at them, "F you, who the hell are you to tell me this," and blah, blah, blah. But most people either ignored what they had to say or tried to educate people. And what I saw most often was a strategy I call redefining companion animal guardianship. And, you know, I found that homeless people had absolutely no trouble getting food for their animals. If they were out in public, just members of the community would come by and give them bags of dog food or cat food, boxes of biscuits. And I thought I was going to be a good Samaritan and reward people for talking to me by giving them a small bag of dog food and turns out or cat food. And it turns out that they always, in all cases, although they were grateful for anything I gave them, they didn't need pet food. And so, and this is also the case with the veterinary clinics. The veterinary clinics provide donated dog and cat food and biscuits and treats. And so I use this notion that you get resources from one source to then protect yourself from assaults from another source. So they would get the dog food from the veterinary clinic, and then they would be able to say, "Look, I feed my dog. My dog eats first." And they would redefine guardianship. In terms of, here's what they'd say. They'd say to someone, "Well, where's your dog? At home in a crate all by himself for 8 hours, 10 hours? My dog's with me 24/7. My dog is out in the fresh air. My dog gets to run around in the park. My dog's got other people and other dogs with them all the time." So they would redefine themselves as even better guardians than people with homes could be, because they would just leave their dogs alone all day.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so they would, I talk about this as a strategy for creating a positive moral self. You know, they would take the resources that they had access to, the donations of food, and use that to make sure they'd say, look, my dog ate today, I've got plenty of food. Look, here's a 20-pound bag of food right here.
Well, you talk about how this strategy, it's not just in order to alleviate the stigma, but also kind of it makes them feel, I guess, more, I don't remember the term that you use, but sort of more like a person in the sense that, you know, they're homeless, they're already stigmatized, they're already kind of down on their luck, but having a pet kind of elevates them to a different status.
That's right. They, you know, as I said, homeless people face so many assaults from members of the public that they encounter on a daily basis, assaults to their character. And having an animal might provide, you know, the kind of psychological benefits. But when they're able to say, look, I've got food, I provide for my dog, my dog always eats first, then they're able to present themselves as a person who's responsible and worthy and deserving of animal care, companionship.
Could you talk a little bit about the different categories of homeless people that you interviewed? Because you noted some differences between them.
Yeah, I found people who were, first of all, the newly homeless. You know, they were on the streets for approximately 6 months less, and they were usually struggling to learn the ropes of being homeless. I had more than one person tell me that there's a skill set associated with being homeless, and that it takes a long time to learn how to get, how to qualify for the resources that you're eligible for, where to find a safe place to sleep, where to find places to park, and things like that. So those newly homeless people were really struggling to learn what they needed to learn, but also they were still hoping to be able to get off the street pretty soon. There were also straddlers, people I call straddlers. And these were people who were back on the street for a second or third time, or maybe they were chronically homeless, you know, having bounced on and off, in and out of homelessness for a number of years. And so they were straddlers in the sense that they had a foot in both the domiciled world and the street world. And there were also homeless youth or travelers who happened to be mostly youth. And these were kids who hitchhiked or walked or hopped trains, often with their dogs. And they used their animals. They really relied on their animals for protection. They slept in some very, very scary places. And I also had the opportunity to talk with some people who had recently gotten off the street after quite long bouts with homelessness, either a single bout of long duration or chronically homeless for a long period of time. And I discovered that they all have different kinds of relationships with their animals, although they certainly, you know, have some similarities, that the circumstances of one's homelessness shape the way you relate to your animal, the kinds of things that you draw from the relationship, whether it's the protection that you need because you're a young person traveling and sleeping in doorways, or whether it's the friendship and the stability you need because you're newly on the street and everything is just unfamiliar and scary. So
these new people, these people that were just recently homeless, did they get a dog after they were homeless, or did they have the dog before and then become homeless?
In most cases, they had the dog before they became homeless. There were just a few people who had acquired animals beforehand. And I've been talking mostly about dogs here, so I do want to put in equal time for for cats.
Yes!
You know, I said before, dogs are just more portable. They're more easy to move around in public with, but I did run into people who had cats and even some fairly large numbers of cats. And these were mostly people who lived in stable in air quotation marks situations, such as abandoned buildings or junked vehicles. I talked to one woman who lived in a junked school bus that was in a storage yard, and she had, you know, dozens of cats that she cared for. So, and I met a couple of people who traveled around with cats, but by and large, you know, their needs just don't really lend themselves all that well to traveling the way that dogs do, because they can walk more easily next to a person. But I did talk to people who had lots and lots of cats. They either had them before they were on the streets, or they lived in situations where you know, they'd had a cat or two, and then it was a situation like a junkyard or a storage yard where people would regularly dump cats anyway, and so they began taking care of all these additional stray and abandoned animals.
Something you mentioned that I thought was interesting is, in terms of the demographics, that most of your female respondents had partners or spouses, but most of the men were single. Do you have any idea why that is?
I can speculate. My sample I had no intention of doing, you know, a generalizable, statistically reliable sample. So I can't generalize from the people I interviewed, but from what I know about the research on homelessness at large or overall, there are more resources available to women, especially women with children. So you see fewer of them as a rule on the street to start with. And the men who are on the street have simply, you know, they've been in situations where they've often been to jail or they have addiction issues, and they have simply worn out the social safety net that they had around them. You know, they've gotten divorced or they've been in a bad relationship, and they've, you know, their parents are dead, or they've, you know, been more or less disowned by their families. So I think it had a lot to do with behavioral issues surrounding, you know, criminal records, addiction, and the fact that there are fewer women out there in the first place. So, yeah, I found that interesting, too. But as I said, it's not a statistically generalizable sample. So I can only speculate based on some of the research I know that exists already.
Right. You talk about some of the ways in which homeless people view their pets, the kind of relationship they have with them. So some people view them as friends and some people as family. Can you talk a little bit about that and the differences that you saw?
Yeah, I really struggled, by the way, with the friend and family category, because one reviewer for the book said, well, you know, we don't choose our family. We're stuck with them for better or for worse. And some people have a lot of trouble with family members. So do you really want to say that this is a good kind of relationship? And what I was getting at there was that the family, saying that an animal is like a family member, is more like saying the dog or the cat is your child or your baby, your son or your daughter. And I did hear a lot of that. But then I also heard a lot of more egalitarian language of friendship. And that's not, absolutely not to say that I'm putting one above the other. I'm not saying friendship is better than being a family member, and I'm trying not to associate any baggage with the term family. I'm just trying to say that there's a kind of a parental relationship, but there can also be a peer relationship where this is my best buddy. And I'll point out too that people often use the same both terms in the same sentence. They would say, "Yeah, he's my best buddy," or "She's my best buddy. She's my little girl." So, you know, they that's why I had to deal with the terms together, friend and family.
Right, right. I think you said at some point, correct me if I'm mistaken, that men used the language of family more often than women, or no?
Yeah, they did. And this gets back to the point you made where I think that men on the street, you know, they by and large don't have these other relationships that the women had, either through children or spouses or human companions.
Hmm. Did you see this as an advantage or a disadvantage in terms of this speaking of, you know, pets as children, let's say?
I can see, I saw the definite benefits of it for people who use that language. You know, they would, it would allow them to give themselves a little bit of credit for their ability to take care of another being in the way that a parent would take care of a child. And again, I'll go back to the point where these are people who just, you know, at every turn, every aspect of society, they're being told that they're unworthy, undeserving, not qualified, unable to do whatever, not responsible, that they've brought on their own fate. And then to have a relationship where they're able to put themselves or depict themselves in the position of a care provider, that really does give them a moral sense of self-worth that I saw as incredibly valuable.
You talk about something called the promissory self, which I think relates to this. Could you kind of explain what that is and how you saw that?
Yeah. The promissory self is comes out of a relationship with an animal. It's something that it's a sense of who one could be or I'll use the word should be if things were different. And so this is kind of like, you know, if I could do that, then I would be. You know, we wish for things to happen because then everything would be perfect. This is, you know, something that could happen in the future. And the animal is part of that, of helping that person reach that goal. So that's why I use the term promissory, that it's like, oh, now I have this dog with me and together we're going to get off the street, or together the future's going to be better because I have him or her.
So most people that you spoke to were relatively optimistic about their futures?
I would say yes, or neutral. I talked to very few people who were really in situations of doom and gloom. But I also should say that I was really focused on their relationship with their animals. So I wasn't. I did talk about their prospects for housing. I asked everyone, "What would it take to get yourself off the street?" And so we talked about those circumstances. But I was really focused on the relationship with the animal, which, for the most part, is the best part of their lives. And they were at veterinary clinics where they were receiving free care for the animals that they loved. So it was a selective environment. You know, I wasn't asking them about the things that were might have been real downers. Although I did hear, you know, in that population, you do hear tragic stories. But by and large, I was asking them about a positive part of their lives. So, yeah, they were largely optimistic.
You talk about one category of homeless people called travelers, and which I think are young people who want to be homeless almost, correct me if I'm wrong, and that they had a shockingly optimistic outlook, that it kind of surprised you.
They did, and I was very cautious about not sounding like I was romanticizing. So the travelers were, by and large, young people who, you know, we might call them transients. They preferred not to define themselves as homeless. They defined themselves as traveling, which is why I use the term. And so they would just, at some point in their young lives, hit the road. And ideally for them, most of them, there was a dog involved. And they would hitchhike or hop freight trains, and I have to say, I really didn't, until I did this research, I thought that was something that pretty much went out with the, you know, I knew about hobos hopping freight trains in the 1930s, but I really didn't think that people did much of that anymore, but the kids kind of took it as, you know, a badge of, a milestone in their lives if they had done that, and they all said that their dogs hated it, by the way. But
yeah,
the travelers were, interestingly, they were about the same age as the students I teach at the university, but they and they were in very, very different circumstances. You know, they just had what they had in their backpacks, and they really saw themselves as self-assured, and that they were doing what they claimed to be wanting to do. Now, they could have been just really skilled at spinning identities for, you know, this middle-aged researcher who was sitting in front of them. But because I saw it so frequently, I began to think that, you know, there must be something to it. Otherwise, every single person couldn't be faking in the same way. But they were very, as I said, self-assured. They knew that they were living a kind of life that they claimed to have chosen. Now, whether to the extent to which they actually did choose those circumstances, I can't say. I don't know enough about individual backgrounds. I do know that a lot of kids who mature out of the foster care system in the United States, when they turn 18, they're essentially, you know, kicked out of the house. They have no resources, and a lot of former foster kids end up homeless. So there's a real question about how you can say that's a choice. And some of them came from very abusive backgrounds, but some of them made a decision that they wanted to, you know, see the country and see if they could do this on their own, just making their own way. And I saw them, you know, dispositionally as much more optimistic and confident than the students I'm in contact with every day, who can't seem to handle, you know, they have a breakdown if their printer runs out of ink or something like that. And again, I didn't want to romanticize the because their lives were certainly hard and dirty and you know, not something I would want to emulate in any way. But I was impressed by them. In general.
Any idea why you think they're so much more optimistic than the students that you're with? Is it a sort of, I don't know, I guess when you have your basic needs met, maybe there's some kind of settling that goes on, or
It could be that. It could be that there is, you know, even among the kids on the street, even if they didn't actually choose their life, there is this kind of youthful rhetoric of choice that, you know, kind of a defiant, this is what I want to be doing thing, and I'm, you know, I'm living the life the way I want to live it. And, you know, middle-class kids in college, I think, although many of them appreciate what they have, I think they feel like they're just kind of following the rules. And so there isn't that,
right,
that defiance that I saw among the travelers.
That makes sense. So in terms of this research, what do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I would, at the practical level, I would love to see individuals have more, you know, respect for homeless people and their animals on the street. I'm not advocating for more homeless people on the street. I'm just saying the next time you see a homeless person with an animal or without an animal, you know, look them in the eye, say good morning. If you don't want to give them a donation of money, that's fine, but maybe then donate to a local nonprofit that reaches out to homeless people. And if you have a burden in your heart for animals, you might want to contribute to any of the organizations that do provide services for the pets of the homeless. And at the level of policy, I would really like to see policymakers and nonprofits recognize the extent to which animals really are important parts of people's lives. And this is a bigger issue, too, because, you know, in my field of sociology, sociologists still don't recognize that people consider animals as family members, too. In fact, there are more households with animals in the United States than there are households with children. And I think, you know, with the recognition that animals are part of people's families, I think we could, you know, we could begin to allow them in subsidized housing more than we do. Having an animal might involve a set of skills that translates well to being a responsible tenant, for example. And so allowing someone to keep a pet when they get off the street and get into housing might have benefits in the long term. So practical level, I would say just be nicer, be kinder. And on a policy level, let's begin to think bigger, think outside the box of a nuclear family for housing. And I understand that the homeless have many, many, many needs, mental health needs, substance abuse needs, job skills, chronic illness. And at the risk of adding just one more thing to the list, I would like to see companion animal relationships taken into consideration. And that's just not, you know, I see that I can get this apartment, so I'll run out to the I'll run to Craigslist and get an animal. But there are ways that we could establish evidence of responsible guardianship. You know, is this animal spayed or neutered? Do you have a license? Is the rabies vaccine up to date? In the case of dogs, do you have a collar and leash? That kind of thing. You know, that we have the canine good citizenship test in this country for dogs who are going in to do visitations in hospitals and nursing homes. And we could have some sort of policy along those lines for landlords to determine whether the animal is well behaved enough to live in a rental housing.
Right. Great. So if people want to know more about this research and buy your book, where should they look? Is it on Amazon?
It is on Amazon. Any local bookstore can order it if it's not on the shelf. Or you can go directly to Lynn Reiner Publishers and order it online.
Great. Leslie, thank you so much for talking to us today about your book.
My pleasure, Annie.
You have been listening to an interview with Leslie Irvine on her new book, My Dog Always Eats First, Homeless People and Their Animals. This is your host, Annie Sapukaya. Thank you for listening to New Books in Sociology.